The term cognitive bias or cognitive illusion is also a term that gets used a lot, was initially proposed as a way of thinking about how our judgments went awry, our decisions went awry, and therefore to give us a kind of insight into how we actually make decisions. So the analogy with visual illusions is quite a useful one. So often when we look at visual illusions, they tell us something about how the visual system works. So famous illusions, like there's one called the Muller-Lyer illusion. It's one where you have two lines and there's arrows that point inwards on one line and point outwards on another line. And the direction that the arrowheads point make it look like one line is much longer than the other. But in fact, they're the same, they're exactly the same length. And the fact that we see those lines as different lengths tells us something about how the visual system works. It tells us something about how it kind of adapts, but it also shows some biases, some departures from reality, if you like. And Kahneman and Tversky in their early work kind of used this idea of analogy with visual illusions to talk about cognitive bias or cognitive illusions.
I'm joined today by Professor Ben Newell, Professor of Cognitive Psychology at the University of New South Wales and the Deputy Head of the School of Psychology. Ben's research focuses on the cognitive processes underlying judgment, choice, and decision-making, and the application of this knowledge to the environmental, medical, financial, and forensics contexts. He is the lead author of Straight Choices, The Psychology of Decision-Making, and is on the editorial boards of the Psychonomic Bulletin and Review, Thinking and Reasoning, Decision Journal, and the Journal of Behavioral and Decision-Making and Experimental Psychology. Thank you very much for joining me, Ben.
It's a pleasure.
Look, I think to jump into it, Ben, in terms of exploring my interests, psychology, cognitive bias, and decision-making has always been of interest to me. I think anyone that has had experiences with adult as a young person and decisions that you wouldn't really think make sense have led me to thinking, well, that's interesting. Why do people make those decisions? And then insofar as bigger problems like climate, I think that definitely comes to mind as well when you think there's all this evidence that's come out from the scientific community since the 90s, since the 80s really, and global action on things like climate, biodiversity, and even other bigger problems, which I'm sure your research focuses on. It makes you wonder how can decisions be made the way that they're being made. So I thought to begin with, I wanted to see if you could explain, you know, what are cognitive biases and how do they impact our decision making?
Well, it's a big topic. It's a huge topic. The notion of a cognitive bias, I guess, was popularized first by the work of Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky, who many people who've got even a fleeting interest in this area will probably have heard about. And the term cognitive bias or cognitive illusion is also a term that gets used a lot, was initially proposed as a way of thinking about how our judgments went awry, our decisions went awry, and therefore to give us a kind of insight into how we actually make decisions. So the analogy with visual illusions is quite a useful one. So often when we look at visual illusions, they tell us something about how the visual system works. So famous illusions, like there's one called the Muller-Lyer illusion. It's a bit hard to describe on a podcast, but it's one where you have two lines and there's arrows that point inwards on one line and point outwards on another line. And the direction that the arrowheads point make it look like one line is much longer than the other. But in fact, they're the same. They're exactly the same length. And the fact that we see those lines as different lengths tells us something about how the visual system works. It tells us something about how it kind of adapts. But it also shows some biases, some departures from reality, if you like. And Kahneman and Tversky in their early work kind of used this idea of analogy with visual illusions to talk about cognitive bias or cognitive illusions. And the sort of classic ones are things like the availability bias, the representativeness bias, and anchoring. So to give a basic illustration of those, an availability bias is when I ask you, you know, which of two events might be more likely, that a person is murdered or that a person commits suicide. And at the time when this work was being done, the overwhelming response that people had to that was murder. And the explanation for that was that reports of murders are often more prominent in the media than reports of suicides. And so when you try to think about instances of murders versus suicides, more instances of murder come to mind than suicide. And so you think, oh, well, look, the answer is probably murder. And they described that kind of effect as the operation of an availability heuristic or availability bias. And again, the analogy to the illusions is that most of the time, you know, our visual system is highly adaptive and it works very well, but sometimes it leads us to see things erroneously. Availability, usually, you know, the ease with which I can generate an instance or think of instances, how quickly they come to mind, is usually a very good cue or heuristic for making a judgment about frequency. But on occasions, it will lead to the wrong type of decision. It will lead to this biased estimate. So that's one type of cognitive bias. Another type of cognitive bias is where you can show that people's judgments and decisions don't necessarily follow rational normative expectations. So a lot of the discussion in the literature is between this sort of caricature homo economicus, the individual that follows only maximizing utility and thinking about the money effectively, you know, the economics of the situation, versus the Homo sapiens, who is characterized as someone that has more kind of cognitive limitations. They don't have unlimited resources to make these kinds of decisions. And so you can demonstrate that those kinds of things are operating if you give people simple choices between gambles, and you can show that they're not necessarily choosing according to a rational expectation, or you can show that they deviate from the predictions of, say, probability theory. So people will judge on the basis of similarity of instances rather than judging in terms of the rules of probability. And the classic example of that is known as the conjunction fallacy or the conjunction bias, which is there's a problem called the Linda problem, which some people may have come across. And that's also explained then in terms of this representativeness. And that's been a very powerful metaphor for thinking about this relationship between how people actually make decisions and what rational or normative prescriptions are. Hopefully we'll get into it a bit later on. I think that there's, you know, and I'm not the only person that thinks this, but that there's been too much emphasis then on the cognitive bias side, too much emphasis pushing towards the idea that we're kind of cognitive misers. You know, we avoid mental effort. We need help in making decisions all the time. And there's a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy or perpetuating metaphor there that is disempowering. And I think that's problematic, especially when it comes to big issues like climate change.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think we'll definitely get into that because, as something which is related to maybe more social psychology is the idea of maladaptive behavior, where if you're grown up in a certain environment, you sort of grow up sort of adapting as a child in response to those environmental factors, and such that when you grow older, you're able to sort of you may carry those behaviors and they become maladaptive, and so it would be more than happy to jump into that later. Something I thought when I first came across cognitive dissonance or cognitive bias, I was learning about it in a marketing class, and the lecturer who was sort of explaining cognitive dissonance was explaining it in a way that I didn't really think it really captured the relative importance of the topic or how it can impact individuals on such a wide scale. And so I thought I'd tell a very quick story, which you may be familiar with, but there was this member in America. There was a young man called Derek Black, and his father was a very prominent member of the Ku Klux Klan. And once he got to the age of university, he eventually went to university, to a relatively small college. And over the year of his first year at university, he was sort of people came up to find out that he was this prominent member. But he had this friend who was pretty sympathetic to his position, could understand that, you know, if you've grown up in a certain environment, it's not going to be any surprise that you're going to have these very strong beliefs. But instead of pressing him on his beliefs, which everyone had been doing at the university once they found out, he sort of just became his friend, went out to dinner with him very often. And then eventually, after gaining his trust and, you know, being close friends, he started sort of challenging him on his positions. And unlike before, where if someone had challenged him on his positions regarding sort of racial ideas, whatever Ku Klux Klan members believe, because if it came from a non-friend, someone he didn't trust, he could just discredit what they said, really. Whereas because it was his friend challenging him and he'd sort of trusted him and been friends with him for a long time, he sort of had to really consider what he was saying. And eventually this led to an undoing of his ideology. And now he's a PhD student of history in Florida, and he sort of widely disavows his views, and he's sort of a prominent, anti-radical, figurehead. And so I thought this was a really, really illustrative example of the power of cognitive dissonance, of cognitive bias, and also the power of trust and sort of undoing things that you may not have ideas that you may not have arrived at through true rational thinking. I was wondering if you had any stories or any studies or case studies about the power of good or bad decision making in sort of forming cognitive biases, cognitive dissonance, and the like.
I think that there's a distinction there between the way that you think about cognitive bias and the way you think about cognitive dissonance. And, you know, your story there seems to me to be one of a longer term change in your attitude towards something or your opinion towards something. And as you say, the idea of trust coming into it is really, really important. I mean, I think in general, when we come to issues like the climate or things where people have perhaps deeply ingrained or deep beliefs one way or another, it can be very difficult to change those beliefs. And there's you know, work showing that it's not necessarily so much telling people the facts and trying to get them to think about the facts, but it's aligning the information with their pre-existing socio-political beliefs or their, you know, their values. And if we can align those kinds of things, then rather than trying to completely flip people's attitudes around, it's more about, you know, going with the grain rather than going against the grain with these people. So in terms of I guess specific stories, like, I mean, there are I was reading something the other day written by a guy who is quite active in trying to get climate education and climate literacy into schools, who started his career working in the fossil fuel area and has sort of, you know, come to the realization that, okay, yes, I put a lot of my working life into that industry, and that was a perfectly good industry to be in and to be working in. But at a certain point thought, okay, now I actually want to shift my focus. And I've realized that industry is limited in how much longer we can really go on using those kinds of resources. And so I sort of flipped over a bit like your example, to someone that now is focusing on climate climate education in schools effectively. And and I think, you know, whether that's exposure to rational thinking or whether it's just a gradual change in the information and the environment that you find yourself in and the access to different information that, that you have, whether you trust the sources of information that that you're reading at the, or you're, or that you're accessing. But it's a gradual, I think it's a gradual process. It's not in all of these areas, it's not going to be suddenly we describe these issues in this way and then, you know, it's a magic bullet that suddenly people go, oh right, I get it now, let's all do things about climate change. It's a very broad, humans, I mean, it sounds trite to say it, but we're very complex. We're driven by lots of different motivations and urges and cognitions. And so it's unlikely there's going to be a kind of one size fits all solution to these issues.
Definitely. Well, I think this, talking about complexity in humans, I think it would be a good opportunity to take up sort of the point you were making to begin with. So you were making the point that we have the ability to be sort of fooled by our by visual illusions. We have the ability to be fooled by, I guess, logical fallacies. And although the emphasis is on, you know, how bad we may be or how not perfect we may be, it all comes from somewhere. And so, you know, these are adaptive behavior. So how did, why is this an important factor to sort of take into consideration that it's an adaptive behavior? And what else would you have to say on that front?
Well, I think, you know, the major point is that if we continue to kind of emphasize this metaphor of being biased and kind of being buffeted around by forces that are outside of our awareness. So, you know, another area of interest that I've had over the years is looking at the influence of information that's supposedly outside of our awareness, kind of unconscious influences on decision making. And there's a whole literature that argues that that things that that we're not aware of are driving our behavior. So, you know, we're exposed to some stimulus, we might not even see that stimulus, or we're not aware that it's bad, but somehow it's changing our behavior. And there's, you know, a lot of kind of contentious evidence out there. I've actually got a new book coming out later in the year called Open Minded: Searching for Truth about the Unconscious Mind, and it really goes through some of these so-called demonstrations of unconscious influences, which make us look kind of irrational and perhaps, you know, not highly adapted to the situations that we're in, and shows that, or argues that, the evidence underpinning many of those examples is not particularly strong, and that they can be, you know, you might be able to illustrate these things in experiments where there are demand effects where people are acting in accordance to the way they think the experimenter wants them to behave, or they're very fleeting, very brief influences on behavior, but how they then actually translate into what we're doing out in the world when we're making these more consequential decisions is far less clear what those kind of influences are. So if you combine, you know, that thinking about, okay, the claims that are made for unconscious effects are not super strong, and this overemphasis on being cognitive misers and effort avoiders and biases sort of promulgates this idea that we need help all the time, that we need to be given, you know, direction in the way that we're making our decisions. And this is, you know, the whole area of nudges and sort of behavioral economics has grown up out of that original proposition from the heuristics and biases type perspective. So the heuristics and biases is reinforcing this idea that we need help in making our decisions. And so the nudge idea is, okay, we need to design decision environments, choice architectures where we help people, where we nudge people to make the right choice because they can't do that for themselves. And that has a certain appeal to it, but it also, I think, does reinforce the sort of abdication of responsibility that I can't do it, so you have to change the you know, I can't help myself in taking the chocolate bar off the shelf, so you have to put the chocolate bar in a different place in the supermarket so that I don't take it. And yes, you know, there is clear there is a clear role for that kind of technique and those kinds of things, or you know, I'm going to make the green energy plan your default plan so that you choose it kind of unthinkingly. But it's naive to think that you can change behavior massively using these kinds of little techniques that play on our supposed fallibilities, because we are very complex. We do adapt to different situations. We do have the ability to think, okay, I understand that you want me to choose this option because you've put it in this prominent position. But I don't want to choose that because I have different motivations. I have different values. So again, these techniques are not going to have universal impact and universal effect. And the overemphasis of the cognitive bias, cognitive miser metaphor, I think elevates the idea that these simple techniques will change our behavior. And my perspective is more that we should treat people as, you know, people think, people can work through problems, they can solve very complex situations all the time. And yes, there are certain traits that maybe make us choose things that are easier at the time because we do want to avoid the effort, but not everything and not all the time. And getting that balance between respecting the kind of cognitive competency that we have and designing choices, designing policy environments really in ways that can maximize those competencies rather than assume that we're biased and hopeless is an important balance to strike.
Yes, no, and I do appreciate your optimism, Ben, and pursuit in this area, because I think it's very much needed. And in terms from an ecological point of view, I mean, you see it all the time where ideas of sort of where we sort of disempower people within movements, not intentionally, but sort of pointing at, you know, people have things like confirmation bias, you can't change their opinions, you know, climate deniers, you know, it's so hard, it's just cognitive bias, we can't change it. And so I think the idea of, you know, sort of equipping people with the tools needed to understand that cognitive bias is a thing, but then two, like you said, empowering people by providing them with tools and ideas and critical thinking to sort of overcome ideas that, you know, are purely deterministic. You know, there's nothing I can do. It is what it is. If I walk past a flower shop, I'm going to ask a girl on a date. There's nothing I can do. Those sorts of things. And so I suppose this brings me to the next question, which I would have for you, which is, you know, what can we do effectively about cognitive biases, cognitive dissonance, and how to resolve them? I think the one thing I've heard personally is being aware of it is one of the most important steps. So would you say that first we need to educate the masses on what they are in terms from a general audience point of view, and then step into, well, this is how you overcome it, or can we skip A altogether and just go straight to B? What do you think?
It's a good question. And I think there is, you know, a fair bit of debate about whether just being aware of the fact that you may not make the right, the normatively correct choice when you're dealing with probabilistic outcomes or when you're trying to interpret uncertainty, or, you know, if you're aware of things like availability. So, you know, did I just come up with that answer because it was the first thing that I thought of, and should I just stop and think about that a little bit more? Whether that awareness actually improves your ability to be resistant, if you like, to those kinds of effects. I mean, I think the awareness step is certainly it's a useful discussion to have. It's an important idea to get out there. But I think it does, as I was saying before, it's that risk of it leading to sort of a disempowering state, right? That oh, I'm hopelessly biased, and you know, I can't think for myself, and I'm just going to be, as you say, buffeted around by the walking past the flower shop. There's a huge literature on de-biasing techniques. A lot of it boils down to effectively increasing your critical thinking or second guessing yourself in a way. One of the techniques that gets talked about is this simple kind of consider the opposite strategy. So if you come up with a particular conclusion, you know, a particular answer to a question, then just think, well, what are some other reasons that it might be, you know, something else? So even with, you know, simple questions like, I don't know, how many, with anchoring biases, right? So if I give you a number and then ask you a quantity, so if I say, you know, do you think that the number of seats in the Opera House is more or less than 200? What do you think?
I'd say more than 200. Yeah.
And now, what would you come up with as your answer?
So, because I sort of know how anchoring bias works, I'm sort of thinking, okay, I'm thinking it's much higher than 200, but now I'm thinking, okay, I don't. I want to give a true and accurate answer. I don't know. Maybe like. Maybe 5,000. I don't know. Is that way too high? I don't even know now.
The problem with this example is that I don't know the answer. One of us is going to have to Google it and find out.
Okay, well, I'll Google.
5,000 is too high, but I think it's more like 2,000. But you know, the example, the idea is that
it's actually 5,700. Wow, that was pretty good.
Oh, okay, very good. Better than me. Okay. But the idea is that if I then said. Do you think it's more or less than 20,000? You know that 20,000 is going to be too high, but your estimate that you might then give me maybe would have been higher, right? In your case, because we're talking about it in the context of debiasing, you know, you're thinking through and you're trying to come up with a proper answer. But it's illustrative for two reasons, this example. One is that, so one way to de-bias it is to say, okay, I came up with that estimate of 2,000 or 5,000. How did I come to that? Then maybe I try to think again, what's another strategy that I might use to generate that number? Why might I have got that first estimate wrong? If I can generate another estimate and I then sort of average the two of those, I can sometimes be more accurate. I'm kind of bootstrapping my initial estimate. The other reason though why anchoring in this context and linking back to what I was talking about before is interesting is that in standard conversations where we are, there's a kind of communicative intent between a speaker and a listener, or two speakers, right? So when we're having this conversation, we're giving each other signals in our conversation that, you know, invites one particular answer or imparts a particular information. And if you think about the case of anchoring, if you don't know anything about it, right, then the number that I give you in the question, you might, as a listener, interpret that as having some use, right? Why would I, as a speaker, say 200 if 200 was a completely irrelevant number? Or why would I say 2 million if 2 million was a completely irrelevant? And you know that as a listener, right? And so this is a sort of another perspective on how these things work is an idea called information leakage, which is the idea that in the way the question is asked or the way the information is framed, there is additional information that leaks from that. So the fact that I've given you the 200 provides a kind of cue or a signal to you that, oh, well, maybe it's around 200, because if it's not, you know, why would you tell me that? And the fact that I can make you look silly or you can make me look silly by giving a number that's completely wrong is perhaps not because you're being irrational. It's just that you're taking a cue that I've used and using it in good faith, and that's leading you to a wrong answer. So as the experimenter, I can then laugh at you and say, oh, you got it wrong. Or in your case, you can laugh at me because I got it wrong. But do you see the distinction that I'm making? That there's
absolutely
information in the way that I have chosen to frame that, which questions the rationality of the judgment.
It's super intuitive, and you can understand. I mean, perhaps this is an ick of people like yourself, where I sort of go back to sort of primordial ages. But I could see if in that context the ways things are. It's not only about what is in that moment, but what else is being signaled, and then creating intuitions from whatever the stimuli is giving you. So it's sort of like a dual information process in that sense. It's what is being presented and what else is being signaled.
Yeah.
And I can imagine that would be, you know, very helpful.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we wouldn't have developed in the way that we had if we couldn't. Well, for a start, to be able to use those signals that come through language and communication. But yeah, drawing inferences from information that is not necessarily apparent, but that is implied is a highly, it's a high level cognitive skill, but it's one that serves us very well and therefore can be adaptive. And if you bring that lens to it, then, you know, a lot of the so-called cognitive biases and errors can be reconsidered in a slightly different light.
Absolutely. And so I suppose just to summarize what you were saying about debiasing techniques, because I thought it'd be very helpful. Mm. So one of the first things is considering the opposites, which I suppose, to use an example, is if you're in a debate team, when you're preparing for debates, it's imperative that you not only prepare for your argument, but you prepare for their argument. And the rationale is that you need to be able to think as well as they think on their topics in order to win the best argument. So that's sort of an example I'd sort of attribute to your answer. And the second thing was that I took from what you were saying is focusing on the process of the thinking rather than on the outcome of the thinking. Mm. And by doing that, you're ensuring that one, if you come to a faulty conclusion, you can just change the process by which you're thinking about something, as opposed to sort of trying to post ad hoc rationalize some bad argumentation to get to the answer that you want. Mm-hmm. So I guess, and this can be done for any sort of position or any argument for climate change, you can sort of badly rationalize arguments to sort of say this is why climate change is the most important, and then climate giant deniers can do exactly the same. So focusing on that process of critical thinking, how you're approaching the argument, how you're sort of considering all the information, that's what I'd say is also important. Would you agree with that
summarization? Yeah, I think that's a good way to characterize it. It is thinking about how the process of thinking leads to a particular outcome, and if you can sort of take ownership of that, the steps that you're going through and the information that you're using at each stage, and reflecting on, you know, why is it that I'm, or is this source of information one that I should be relying on when I'm making this? Why has this come to mind? I mean, I realize that it starts to paint, you know, it potentially paint you into a corner of I'm never going to make a decision about anything if I'm evaluating each step. But, you know, that we're not talking about every decision that we make. I mean, I often, you know, see people talking about, oh, we make 30,000 decisions every day or 80,000, whatever this, you know, whatever the number is. I never really see what they mean. What they actually, how they actually,
yeah, what's the implication?
How they define a decision in that case, right? I mean, is me picking up my water bottle, is that a decision? Does that count as one of the 100,000? If so, you know, that's not something that I need to be concerned about. Should I vote for a party that is advocating for taking strong action on climate change? That's a decision that I should be thinking about.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, speaking about decisions and climate change, I thought I'd ask you, what are the cognitive factors or I guess psychological cognitive factors that make people more or less likely to take action on climate change? if you're familiar with.
Yeah, we did a bit of work a few years ago looking at how people sort of perceive the risk of climate change and also the predictors of their willingness to do something about it in terms of just sort of intended action rather than actual action in our case. And in our work and lots of other work that's been done in this area shows that one of the key drivers is what's known as sort of efficacy or inefficacy. In other words, my perception that I can actually do something that will make a difference. And unsurprisingly, if you feel like your actions are going to count and that they can have some kind of impact and some agency, then you are more likely to say, yes, I'm going to take action here. Other things that are shown to be strong predictors are things like your political persuasions, your overall values, you know, whether you sort of espouse environmental values. And, you know, this is tricky because if it's really about a value story, then how do you change people's values? How do you get at, you know, people's ideological, political perspectives? Are those just so kind of rusted on that it becomes hard? But I think one way that you can address that is, like I was saying before, I think at one point that you have to try and kind of align options, actions that people can take to those values rather than going against them. So you have to make appeals that are going to be, you know, if you have someone whose main focus is on improving the economic situation, then you might want to pitch things like the fact that renewables are now, you know, a better investment than fossil fuels. If it's someone whose values are very much more in the environmental sustainability space, then you can be pitching it in terms of reducing pollution or improving green spaces around the city or whatever it might be. So again, there's not going to be a one size fits all here. But I think those kinds of what that then suggests is that the solutions that we need to offer have to be ones where people feel that they do have agency, have to be ones where they feel that they can actually have some kind of influence. And whether you can do that by emphasizing, you know, the impact of collective action over single actions, you can do that by emphasizing the powers that governments and corporations can have if they make these changes. And you can also emphasize it through, you know, the single actions that we can all take. But I think that the frustration there is, and the reason that people sometimes feel that low efficacy or low impact, is because, you know, we can take these actions, but we can see lots of people around us who aren't. And that then feels demotivating and debilitating. And so overcoming that kind of issue is important. But I think, you know, when I started off looking at this work, I came from a, you know, cognitive psychological background, and I was interested in, still am interested in, you know, the mechanisms underlying how people kind of understood the basics of things like the carbon cycle, or how they understood the uncertainty around projections and so on. And all of those factors, I think, contribute once you can get a clearer picture of how all these different pieces are put together. But again, it's not going to be the single the single magic bullet that's going to change people's attitudes.
Maybe to sort of dive into some sort of fun areas. Let's say you were in an omnipotent leader, Ben, where you had the power to change people in a positive way. using your research and the lessons learned from, you know, cognitive psychological factors and all that sort of research, you know, what lessons and principles of judgment and decision making would you sort of download onto our collective consciousness, making us better for the foreseeable future?
That's a great question. I mean, it's hard to answer that without sounding without kind of sounding pejorative in some way, right? I mean, what I would like to emphasize is, and I guess this comes back to some of the biases or failures in our thinking that are often talked about in the context of climate change, and that is this notion of kind of present bias, or that we have an undue focus on the now rather than on the future. And there's lots of adaptive stories that you can make for why that should be the case, right? And there's lots of work that, you know, all of the work that's looked at how to improve people's savings for retirement focuses on this idea, right? That we discount the future. And I think if there was one cognitive faculty that I would download onto people, would be some way to improve, I guess, that connection between the now and the future. Because I think that it's a sort of obvious thing to say, but one of the things that makes climate change difficult to deal with is because it's not just implications for us, it's implications for people who are going to be around a long time after we've gone. And getting people to think more in that way, and getting people to try and overcome some of the kind of myopic decisions that they're making would be useful. But as I say, it's very easy to say that kind of thing. You know, if you think about it in the context of saving for retirement, it's very easy to say you should be saving more for your retirement because once you get there, you're not going to have enough. But we're back to this, you know, people's actual motivations and beliefs and values. There might be very good reason why I'm not saving more at the moment, because I just don't have the capacity to do it, or I have a particular, you know, motivation to want to live fast and die young, or whatever, you know, whatever it might be. And it's not necessarily for me as the person to dictate. Now there may be a role that it's for me because it's in the best interests of the broader society to do that, and it might not be very good for you to personally, if I say you can't drive your big gas guzzling car every day to work anymore, that's inconvenient for you. But if you had the capacity, or if you were more willing to entertain the ideas about the impact of that on the future and on future environments, and you could see, okay, yeah, right, it might be easier for me to drive today, but the cumulative impact of that in 20, 30, 40, 50 years time is such that I could probably take the pain of having to get the bus today instead. It's that kind of trade-off that I think would be really a good additional faculty for people to have.
That's
as best as I can come up with.
Yeah. So the short answer is not more flower shops to make people more infatuated with the future, but just a stronger connection to thinking about posterity. I think that's brilliant. And there's a phrase that I've sort of taken, which I use a lot with the podcasts, called The Good Ancestor by an Australian philosopher, where he sort of invokes this idea of, you know, the Good Samaritan. It's a really good principle and very easily accessible to people as sort of remember to do good. But why not invoke such a principle in a very long time horizon by saying, why don't we be good ancestors? And I find that to be incredibly I guess illuminating is one way to put it. But so I think it's a call to action for us to be good ancestors.
I like that phrase. That's a good way of summarizing it. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think we're pressed for time, Professor. So thank you very much, Ben, for joining me today. If people want to find your profile.
Pleasure.
Yeah, absolutely. If people want to find your profile, what you're up to, want to learn a bit more about you, where can they find you?
So I have a website that's hosted at UNSW, so you can find me there. I can send you the link if you want to put it in there.
Yep, sure.
The podcast. You can reach out to me there.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Ben. Please stay with me in the green room, and thank you for joining me again.
Pleasure. It was a really interesting conversation. Thanks.